Faculty and administrators have been faced with new challenges and opportunities as higher education adapts to a rapidly changing environment. In this episode, we discuss strategies that colleges and universities can adopt to navigate a successful path forward. Thanks for joining us for Tea for Teaching, an informal discussion of innovative and effective practices in teaching and learning.
This podcast series is hosted by John Kane, an economist,
and Rebecca Mushter, a graphic designer,
and features guests doing important research and advocacy work to make higher education more inclusive and supportive of all learners.
Our guest today is the State University of New York Chancellor, John B. King, Jr. He has a long history of involvement with education. After graduating from Harvard, Dr. King acquired a master's degree from Teachers College, Columbia University, and taught high school social studies. He later co-founded Roxbury Preparatory Charter School and served as a co-director for 5 years. Under his leadership, students in the school attained the highest scores of any urban middle school in the state and closed the racial achievement gap. After acquiring his doctoral degree from Columbia and a law degree from Yale, he served as New York State's Education Commissioner from 2011 to 2014. Dr. King left New York for a while to work in the Obama administration as Deputy Secretary of Education from 2015 to 2016 and joined Obama's cabinet as Secretary of Education from 2015 to 2016. Following his work in the Obama administration, Dr. King continued to advocate for increased educational equity and access as President and CEO of the Education Trust. Welcome, Chancellor King.
Thanks so much. Excited to talk with you all.
Today's teas are... Chancellor King, are you drinking any tea with us today?
I am. Sweet ginger citrus tea. And this is part of my New Year's resolution. I've always been a tea drinker, but I also am a longtime coffee drinker. But a New Year's resolution this year was to put the coffee aside and switch only to herbal, no caffeine tea. So that's what I'm working on.
Well, I'm glad that you decided to record this podcast then as part of your New Year's resolution.
It fits in perfectly.
And following that theme, I am drinking a spearmint and peppermint blend tea as another herbal tea.
I may have noted that I was trying to cut down on caffeine in an earlier podcast, but I happen to have a Scottish afternoon tea today.
No.
Which is a bit more caffeine than the breakfast teas.
Yeah, my accountability isn't working well.
There are so many things we'd like to discuss with you, but given the time limitations of the podcast, we'd like to focus on your views of the challenges and opportunities facing higher education today. What do you see as the major opportunities in higher ed today?
I think higher ed is foundational to the long-term success of both our economy and our democracy. We have vital roles to play in both. Certainly, we have tremendous opportunities in the state to prepare students for success in the semiconductor industry, which is rapidly growing in the state, for success in healthcare, where we have tremendous needs, success in green jobs, and some of the resilience work that we're going to need to do as a society because of climate change, tremendous opportunity to prepare students for every conceivable profession, from teachers to writers to actors to artists. And we have a crucial role to play in the health of our democracy. We've got to make sure that we are preparing all of our students with a rich liberal arts education so that they can be critical thinkers, so they can be critical consumers of modern media, so that they can be discerning, so that they can make decisions as voters, as neighbors, as citizens. And we've got to make sure that our institutions are able to meet both of those missions across degree programs.
What are some of the ways that we can move forward on some of those opportunities?
Well, look, we are very fortunate that last year, Governor Hochul and the legislature made such a significant investment in SUNY, $163 million, the largest operating aid increase SUNY has received in 20 plus years. It allowed us to make double-digit percentage increases in state support at all of our state-operated campuses, as well as to invest funds in mental health services, services for students with disabilities, internships just critical to preparing students for those transitions to career. We were able to put $10 million towards the expansion of research, which is another critical role of the higher ed sector and the health of our society. And we're able to dedicate consistent funds for supporting our food pantries across our institutions because we worry about our students who are struggling with food insecurity. So one way we move forward is through continuing to invest in the strength of our institutions. Another important way that we can move forward on that agenda is continuing to adapt our offerings, our programs, creating new paths for students. Very excited about the governor's announcement around AI and the creation of Empire AI and what will be a significant investment in SUNY's ability to prepare students for research and careers and ethical use of AI. Very excited about the new Stony Brook Climate Resilience Campus, $700 million campus that will be built on Governor's Island, just off the coast of Manhattan. So we've got to continue to evolve as we respond to the opportunities and challenges for our economy and for our democracy.
Speaking of challenges, what do you see as the major challenges facing higher ed today?
There are, unfortunately, a number of major challenges. Many of our institutions, certainly at SUNY, but private institutions in the state, higher ed institutions across the country have seen significant declines in enrollment. And that was all exacerbated by COVID. That said, I'm a glass half full, teacup half full kind of guy. And I look at that and I say, part of what we need to do is evolve our thinking about who our students are. We've got to make sure that we're reaching out to every New Yorker to let them know there's a place at SUNY. We've got to do more work to make sure that we are recruiting low-income students, first-gen students, Black and Latino students, Indigenous students, immigrant students, that more of our veterans know that they can come back after their service and find opportunity on our campuses, that folks who are involved in AmeriCorps service programs know that there's a place for them at SUNY, that our working adults know that they can come back to SUNY, whether it's one of our community colleges or one of our four-year institutions, to complete a degree that maybe they started and didn't finish. We've got 2 million New Yorkers with some credits, no degree. Or maybe that they're coming to a campus for a micro-credential or a certificate, but we're going to then help them leverage that into a degree program over time. So there's the challenge of declining enrollment, but there's also the opportunity. We're already seeing progress at SUNY. This is the first year in 10 years that we had an enrollment increase across all sectors. But another major challenge is the attacks that we're seeing on academic freedom, on teaching the truth about our history, the attacks trying to undermine our ability to talk about the hard parts of our history, the times we've fallen short with the promise of American democracy, slavery, the horrific treatment of Native Americans and the way land was taken from them. That's a part of our history. It's just the truth, and we've got to grapple with those hard truths. But there are folks all over the country, unfortunately, who are trying to prevent discussion of those topics. Even states where they're saying they don't want any higher ed institution to mention the word diversity or the word equity. So that, I think, is very dangerous. I'm very proud that in New York, we are standing up for those values. We're going to be the opposite of Florida. We're going to stand up for diversity, equity, inclusion. But I worry a lot about that attack.
One of the concerns that many people have are these attacks on higher ed that are convincing more parents and many students that college is no longer needed because, for political reasons, perhaps, a lot of people are arguing that a college degree is no longer useful. What can we do to help push back against some of those attacks that we're seeing nationwide?
Yeah, you know, there are a few things. I mean, certainly we have to make the value proposition clear. It's important that students understand and families understand that over your lifetime, if you have a bachelor's degree, it will translate into $1 million more of earnings. So there is this very clear value proposition. We've got to take on the affordability question, which a lot of families worry about. You hear so much about the student debt crisis. So we've got to really help folks understand how affordable SUNY is. 53% of our students across our institutions go tuition-free because of the Pell Program and the New York State Tuition Assistance Program, as well as the Excelsior Program. And our tuition, as you know, just over $7,000, is significantly less than many of our peer institutions in neighboring states. It really is possible to get an incredibly high quality education affordably at SUNY, and we have to make sure that parents and students understand that. We've also got to, I think, go back to first principles around what is the purpose and the vision of higher education. The fact of the matter is, you look at almost every indicator, life expectancy, health outcomes, you name it, they're better for folks who have higher education. Well, and what we're aspiring to is to say, come to our institutions for an education that will help you lead a healthier, more fulfilling life. I want you to come to our institution and maybe take art history. And so your life is enriched because when you travel, when you go to a new city, you go to a museum and you discover insights around art that you otherwise wouldn't have had. That's the part of the beauty of higher education. So we've got to make the value proposition argument, the dollars and cents argument, but I don't want us to forget about also making the richness, quality of education argument as well.
As we think about broader access and our student bodies becoming increasingly diverse in a variety of ways, we do see a number of historically minoritized students having lower retention and DFW rates. What can educational institutions do to reduce some of these equity gaps in degree attainment and not just starting?
So important. And at the Education Trust, this was really a major area of focus for us, trying to make the case that institutions have a responsibility to not only recruit first-year students, but to provide the supports necessary for students to complete and go on to success after graduation. One of the things we're working on at SUNY, as I think you know, because Oswego is very much a part of this, we are replicating across 25 of our campuses a program called ASAP for community colleges, or ACE for our four-year institutions. And the idea behind ASAP and ACE, which has been shown to be successful in doubling completion rates in randomized controlled trials, so it has a tremendous evidence base. The core strategy around ASAP and ACE is to provide supports that make it more possible for students to be successful. More intensive advising, cohort experience, help with just-in-time financial assistance for the student who the car breaks down and so then they can't get to their job, they can't get to class, and for want of $250 for the auto mechanic, they end up dropping out of school. ASAP and ACE have shown that if you provide that just-in-time financial support, it can make all the difference. There's also an effort to support transportation so that you try to take that out of the way as an obstacle for students. And I'm very hopeful about the impact that ASAP and ACE can have across our 25 campuses. But more broadly, there's really a cultural commitment we have to make as a community of institutions that we are going to be laser-focused on helping our students complete with a meaningful degree or credential. And so when we see those high DFW rates in a class, we've got to ask, well, is there more we could do in terms of academic intervention? Is there more support that we can provide? Are we seeing patterns for students with disabilities where they're not getting the accommodations they need? Are there opportunities to maybe have those classes structured differently so that students are able to get some of the foundational support they need at the same time as they are tackling new rigorous challenges, but sometimes people refer to as co-requisite classes that integrate the remedial work with actual credit earning college level work. So we've got to just be disciplined about this, and we've got to invest in the programs that we know will make a difference. EOP has been fabulously successful in New York for decades. Again, a set of wraparound supports, a sense of community for students, and importantly, financial assistance.
Are there any specific types of interventions in the classroom that seem to be particularly effective in terms of reducing some of the equity gaps by race, by first-gen status, and by Pell eligibility?
It certainly varies by discipline, but a couple observations. One is relationship building is critically important. Students need to know that you care, and they need to know that they can come for help. When I was teaching at University of Maryland College Park before I came to SUNY, one of the things I would do every year on my syllabus, I would include basically a basic needs statement to say, here's where you can go on campus if you are struggling with food insecurity or housing insecurity, or if you need additional academic support or you need additional mental health support. And here's my contact information and my TA's contact information. And I want you to reach out if you need help in these areas outside of our class. Of course, reach out if you need help with the work in our class. But if you need help in these other areas, please let us know. And just that step of communicating to students, here's where the resources are, and I want you to reach out for help, can be quite powerful. So relationships are critical. A second one I'd point out is, again, it varies by discipline, but opportunities for students to do projects, hands-on learning. We see oftentimes that when classes are only lectures and exams, that students may not get as engaged and it may not be as accessible to students as it could be. It takes more time. It's more complicated to design courses that build in project-based or experiential learning, but we certainly need to be thoughtful about that as we design courses.
I love the examples that you're sharing because they really underscore that sense of belonging a student might gain and really feel seen. Acknowledging that you know students may be housing insecure means you belong here. We know that you might be housing insecure.
That's right. That's exactly right.
One of the things that's had a pretty profound impact on higher ed, or at least it's raised a lot of questions in higher ed, is the rapid development of AI tools ever since the introduction of ChatGPT last year. And we're seeing new tools coming out almost every week or modifications on the existing tools. How do you see this affecting how we teach students and how students learn? And how can we prepare students better for a world in which they'll be working with AI tools that'll be increasingly better developed?
It's a fascinating set of questions. And this, I think, is going to be an important area of discussion for faculties across all of our SUNY institutions for many years to come. I'm very excited that the governor committed to the Empire AI Initiative because that will invest real resources in our institutions to do some of the research to unlock the potential power of AI to advance the public good. You think about some of the opportunities where AI could help with medical diagnosis and the development of treatment plans in medicine. Early days, but we see some opportunities there. We've got a NSF grant at UB, University at Buffalo, to focus on the use of AI as a tool for improving instruction for students with disabilities. And there's tremendous potential there. We know that AI can be leveraged for advances in manufacturing and robotics. So tremendous opportunities to leverage AI. There are also tremendous risks. We have a set of scholars at UB as well who are working on the issue of deepfakes and the risk that deepfakes pose to our democracy and the good functioning of our society. We have a faculty member at UAlbany who is a philosophy professor whose focus through the early part of his career was on trust between people. And now he is writing about and studying trust between people and machines as we think about how AI is reshaping elements of our society. So lots of opportunity here for us on the research side. And also some very real implications for thinking about teaching and learning. Some hopeful things, like how can AI be used to power personalized tutoring for students who may be struggling? How can AI be used to create adaptive learning experiences where the level of challenge is matched to how students are responding to questions? But also, I think a very real fear, will students be doing their own work or will they be using ChatGPT to write their paper? And so it's going to challenge us to think differently about the kinds of assignments we give and where students take those assignments. So lots of questions that I think all of our faculty have to begin to think about, but we can't pretend it's not happening, that it's not changing how students approach their work. And so we've got to be responsive.
And I'm going to put in a plug for an event that SUNY will be sponsoring. There's going to be an AI symposium taking place in Buffalo on May 21st. We're working on a schedule for that, and we will include a link to any information about that in the show notes for anyone who might be interested in joining the discussion with many people from around SUNY about the implications of AI.
There's so much excitement around this. We had an AI task force this past semester that is ongoing, and we had probably 80 faculty members across SUNY institutions participating in that. And I was thinking about lots of different questions about the implications of AI, but I think this is a great chance for us to deepen collaboration across the SUNY system.
You've really highlighted a wide range of both opportunities and challenges that institutions face as a whole. How do faculty see themselves in moving forward in facing some of the challenges in helping students achieve meaningful credentials or really meeting some of the demands of our very near future?
The faculty are the heart and soul of SUNY. I visited all 64 campuses, as I mentioned last year. I'm about halfway through visiting them all again. And I'm just continually inspired by the work I see happening across our campuses, just faculty members who are inspiring students, who are equipping students with critical skills that will help them in their professions and in their lives. So I'm very grateful for that. A couple places where I think there are some real leadership opportunities. One is for faculty to play a role in supporting our recruitment efforts to make sure that when students of color, low-income students, first-gen students are coming to campus, they are hearing a clear message from faculty that they are wanted. One of the worries I have about the Supreme Court decision last year ending race-conscious admissions is that it sent a message to Black, Latino, Indigenous students, you are not welcome in higher education. And we want to send the opposite message. We want to say there's a place for every New Yorker at SUNY. Our classrooms are stronger when our student body is diverse. Our faculties are stronger when they're diverse. Our research is better when diverse researchers are engaged in solving problems together. So recruitment is one opportunity. Second opportunity, I think, is to continually ask, how do we evolve our instruction and our course content to align with our evolving students and our evolving society? Now, we're always going to want students to engage with the great conversation about what is the good life. We're always going to read Plato and Aristotle. But at the same time, we've got to think about how are the questions we're asking maybe different given what our students face today. So I think about when I was at one of our campuses speaking with a botany professor who was saying that he'd really never had full enrollment in his course. He always had empty seats. But this past year, he was teaching a course in the horticulture of cannabis and waitlist. And it wasn't to say that every student in that class is going to get a job in the cannabis industry. You know, certainly the cannabis industry is going to grow in New York, but that course will be a gateway to getting excited about agriculture and an interest in careers in agriculture, which are plentiful. As a whole generation of folks in the agriculture industry retire, we have lots of need for folks with expertise in agriculture, sustainable agriculture in particular. So maybe being in that course on the horticulture of cannabis will bring them into this new field. So it's not that he's teaching something entirely different. It's kind of tapping into the intersection of his discipline and what students are curious about. Similarly, you think about healthcare and the challenges we have in the healthcare sector. Students are really interested in learning about racial health disparities and understanding how we're going to tackle those. And I'm saying diverse students are interested in those questions because they see the horrific maternal health disparities by race that we have, and they want to make it better. So we should talk about that in our nursing classes, in our public health classes, in our medical schools. So this evolution of our teaching and our content to meet the moment, I think, is hugely important. And then I would add, we are stronger together. And so collaboration across disciplines, collaboration across institutions, strengthening transfer pathways, for example. 80% of the students who start community college say they want to earn a bachelor's degree, but less than 20% do. We can do better. We have to do better. And so those partnerships, not only institutional partnerships, so that credits transfer and those things, but also faculty collaboration. What do we advise students about which courses to take if they're interested in a particular degree when they come to the four-year institution? How do we improve advising at the two-year institution? Those kinds of things are an important place where faculty can engage.
As you mentioned, SUNY has done quite a bit of work in easing transfer credit across institutions between community colleges and four-year colleges. But we have those really poor success rates for students who plan to go on for a bachelor's. Are there any other strategies that could be used to help ease that transition from community college into four-year programs?
Absolutely. You know, we have a transfer task force with folks from across our two and four-year institutions working on this set of questions. Some of the things that we're seeing that are promising around the country, advising, crucial, particularly as you're picking classes, as you're thinking about your major and how it will translate into what you want to ultimately do in your career, improving advising at the community college level, particularly if, and we have some folks who are using transformation funds, some of the funding we got last year from Governor Hochul in the legislature to do this, particularly if you can get the four-year institution to either place their staff as the advisors on a two-year campus or to work in very close partnership with the advisors on the two-year campus to help ease that navigation. Another issue is what I might describe as friction reduction. One of the things we started this past year, which we will continue to grow, is a SUNY match process where we reach out directly to students in our two-year programs and say, you are directly admitted to these four-year institutions based on your academic record at the two-year institution. Because for a lot of students, especially first-gen students, it's that feeling of, well, is college really for me? Is a four-year institution really for me? Am I ready for a four-year institution? But it can be transformative to get that letter, that personalized letter that says, there is a place for you at the four-year institution. And then look, there's lowering financial barriers. That's critical. One of the things I'm excited about that the governor announced in her State of the State and included in her budget is universal FAFSA, making sure that students complete the free application for federal student aid, because that's how they know what resources are available to them. And some of our community college students, unfortunately, they don't realize the aid they could have. And so they're struggling to afford the two-year institution and making the choice not to pursue a four-year degree because they don't know the Pell dollars, the TAP dollars that could be there for them. That's why we need them to do the FAFSA. Last year in New York, students left $200 million in federal aid unclaimed because of not completing the FAFSA. And so Governor Hochul wants to require K-12 to work with us in higher ed to make sure that every student either completes the FAFSA, completes the DREAM Act application if they're undocumented, or they and their family would complete a waiver that says, I realize there are billions of dollars available for post-secondary education, and I don't want any. I'm not going to fill out the form. But at least we'll know that every student and family understood the options available to them.
Sounds like some really great opportunities. I'm watching our time and knowing that we're nearing our end of our time. But I'm really curious, before we get to our last question, what you're most excited about working on in the next year?
I love that question. I'll tell you one of the things that I'm very passionate about, I first worked on when I was at the U.S. Education Department. President Obama had an initiative called My Brother's Keeper, which was about trying to improve outcomes for boys and young men of color. And as part of that initiative, I was very involved in kind of leading the agency work on that initiative when I was deputy secretary, and then continued that as secretary. And one of the initiatives that we launched was something called Second Chance Pell. And the history there is that in 94 in the crime bill, there were many problematic provisions, but one that was especially dumb was a provision that banned access to Pell Grants for folks who are incarcerated. Now, of course, the evidence is any educational experience while incarcerated reduces the likelihood of recidivism, and completing a degree while incarcerated dramatically reduces the likelihood of returning to prison. So shamefully, this was part of the tough on crime, punishment first kind of focus of the mid-90s. They banned access to Pell Grants. As a result, programs and prisons all over the country closed. Some remained open through philanthropy, but many, many closed. We wanted to change that. And so we used our experimental authority under the Higher Education Act to create a pilot program called Second Chance Pell, that would allow, at that time, 65 colleges and universities to use Pell Grants with students who were incarcerated. We launched that while I was secretary. And then when I was at EdTrust, a coalition of civil rights groups, criminal justice reform organizations, education equity-focused organizations worked together to get folks to visit those programs, members of Congress, governors, to highlight the incredible stories of the students who graduated from higher ed and prison programs. And we were able to persuade Congress to change the law and restore Pell access generally. So today, Pell Grants are available for incarcerated students. SUNY is already the largest provider of higher education in the state's prisons. We have over 700 students, but we are trying to grow that effort. I want there to be a higher education program in every correctional facility in New York State. I want to make sure that we grow the number of bachelor's programs. We have a lot of associate's degree programs, but I want to make sure that students have the opportunity to go on to their bachelor's degree. I was at a graduation last week, Mid-State Correctional Facility, 5 students graduating from Herkimer Community College. It was so beautiful and inspiring to see the transformative power of education, to hear students talk about how the access to higher education had changed them, changed their lives, changed their prospects for when they come home, but changed them as people. The faculty members were crying. The family members were crying. The folks in the correctional facility were so excited for the students who are graduating. It was truly, truly inspiring. So I'm very excited about that work. I'm looking forward to growing that work. But then more broadly, I'm excited that SUNY is on the move. SUNY is delivering high quality, affordable public higher education, driving economic opportunity for New York State. We are working to improve recruitment, retention, and completion. We are advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion. We are doing the things that we ought to be to better serve New Yorkers. So I'm super excited about our work together.
Those are really important programs, and we're so glad to hear all of this. We always end with the question, what's next? I know you've already addressed a lot of this, but there's so much more.
Well, you know, we try to organize our work around the aspiration that SUNY has to be the best public statewide system of higher education in the United States. And we're the largest comprehensive system, but it's very important that we work to be the best system. To me, that means we've got to deliver on student success. We've got to deliver on research and scholarship. Governor's asked us to double research and scholarship across the system. We've got to deliver on diversity, equity, and inclusion. That means diversity of our students, our faculty, our leadership across our institutions. It means implementing the diversity, equity, and inclusion general education requirement, which is really nation leading to say every student is going to be exposed to diversity, equity, and inclusion content across all of our institutions. And we've got to deliver on economic development and upward mobility, which has been the SUNY tradition for 75 years. So I organize how I think about the work, and certainly our board is organizing its work around those 4 pillars in order to achieve that goal of being the best statewide public higher education system. In the short term, we got a state budget that hopefully will be enacted on April 1. So we got a lot of work to do to make sure we are making the case for investment in SUNY and helping people to see there's a 9-to-1 return on each state dollar invested in SUNY in terms of the economic impact. We need legislators to know that. We need to work with them to make sure that they are investing in the great work that our faculty are doing.
Well, thank you so much for your insight on the current state of higher ed and all the opportunities that we have to improve our society.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to join you. And thanks for fostering dialogue on important issues.
And thank you for giving up your time so generously and all the work that you've done and are continuing to do.
Thanks so much.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast service. To continue the conversation, join us on our Tea for Teaching Facebook page.
You can find show notes, transcripts, and other materials on teaforteaching.com. Music by Michael Gary Brewer.